Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natanael Zelos Palay. On today's episode, keeping faith and sharing space.
I think that we don't always recognize that our efforts to build internal community are impacting the external community that already exists there.
The global coronavirus pandemic has a lot of us thinking about space. How do we make virtual space feel real? What will our physical spaces look like when this is all over? How do I maintain personal space quarantined in a small house with seven other people? It's certainly no coincidence that the Daf Yomi is studying a tractate, Eruvin, that is seemingly obsessed with negotiating the realities of space as it pertains to Shabbat. But it was only recently that the Daf began the second half of the tractate, when the Talmud starts to talk about what happens when you have to share that space with someone who is different from you. It's an uncomfortable topic for some people in the Jewish community, but Professor Hannah Leibovitz is not afraid to broach it. Hannah is an assistant professor of public administration at the University of Texas Arlington and freelance writer who focuses on human-centered sustainability issues related to urban and metropolitan governance. Her work has been featured in local publications such as Cleveland Scene and Cleveland Magazine and national outlets including JTA, The Forward, and Business Insider. Hannah, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
These days, it's not uncommon to find Orthodox Jews in academia like yourself, but generally, they tend to gravitate towards Jewish studies and other humanities. What brought you to the field of urban studies and public affairs?
Ironically, it's actually a pretty Jewish story. Sure, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and then I went to Israel for seminary, and after seminary, moved to New York City to do the thing every girl does to try to get married, and immediately became like this big urbanist. You know, there's this massive public transit system, all these cool housing options, and I just became obsessed with city life. And then I got an opportunity to work for a New York City councilwoman, Gail Brewer, who then went on to become the Manhattan Borough president. And in both positions, I was able to do a lot of community-based work, first from her district office, so really working with constituents. And then she became Manhattan Borough president, working in community development around a land use project. So I really got to experience a big city. I got to work in a big city. I got to think about how that big city is run. And I got really excited about it, and I decided to get a master's degree, and that brought me to Cleveland, to the Levine College at Cleveland State University, which is one of the top urban studies, urban planning schools in the country. And so I got there, I got my master's, and worked for a little bit, and then realized that a lot of what I wanted to do was study cities. I was just fascinated by them. And so sometimes people do this crazy thing where we go back to school and get a PhD, which is just ridiculous. And we never know if we're going to get jobs. It makes no sense. So I went back and, but during my time moving from New York to Cleveland, I was really struck by the dynamics that happen, not just in these, you know, big, cool, fun, awesome cities like New York, but in these smaller cities and in suburbs and in these other kind of spaces, and especially places that have become contentious, where, you know, New York, there's always a fight breaking out in New York for whatever reason. But there are other communities across the US where we assume, you know, things are fine or things are calm, but there's actually a lot of contentious politics and really cool, interesting dynamics around urban space happening in a lot of different communities. And so I became really focused on how these communities can be designed and governed so that we basically care about each other and take care of each other. And that became really my approach. A lot of it also, again, grows out of the Jewish community and this very strong sense that Jews have that we do care for one another. And recognizing that, you know, maybe there are mechanisms that we can kind of create that through governance systems, through spatial design, and thinking more about that. So still pretty Jewish, even though it's not psychology. I know every single time people, when I was in grad school and I would say I was getting my PhD, people would say, well, what field of psychology do you study? I'm like, no, there's other PhDs. So still pretty Jewish though.
Oh, thank you for sharing your story. That's really fascinating. And yeah, I know you're doing really important work for the Jewish community, your writing and your activism, and for the general population.
Yeah, I hope people will start listening. You know, sometimes in our community, I do find that you have to leave a little bit to get certain like credentials sometimes, and then right. You can kind of come back and people will believe you. But mm-hmm. You can't leave too far. You know, you can't do too much and then they think you don't understand the community anymore. So you have to leave just a little bit. You still have to marry like a Lubavitcher with smicha. so like as I did. So you have to keep a little bit of it. But yeah, I mean, I hope people start thinking more. And I definitely agree with your intro. Like, I think COVID has people thinking about space in new ways that we never have.
For sure. Yeah. So let's get into the sugya, shall we? The sixth chapter of Masechet Eruvin, called Hadar, or One Who Lives, discusses the laws of Eruv with respect to a courtyard shared by Jews and non-Jews. On 61b, the first page of the chapter, the Mishnah rules that in order for an Eruv to work in such a space, the Jewish resident must ask permission from the non-Jewish resident by symbolically renting the latter's right to the space. It seems like a fairly innocuous law, but then the Gemara explains that the sages instituted this law to discourage Jews from living in close proximity to non-Jews, who are by default suspected of idolatry, murder, or both. Though it's been more than 1,500 years since this law was written, Jews still tend to live together, and in some cases, gradually lead non-Jewish neighbors to move away. A few months ago, Dr. Rivka Press-Schwartz of SAR High School in New York made the compelling case that the establishment of suburban Jewish day schools in the 1960s contributed to the phenomenon of white flight that entrenched racial segregation in American cities. It's hard not to make the same case about suburban Eruvin. Recently, you yourself have written about the pitfalls and privileges of densely populated, homogenous, Orthodox communities. How can we build Eruvin, and Jewish communities more generally, in ways that do not exclude people who already live in these places, and that do not discourage others who are different from us from moving in?
It's hard, because I think that as a community, it's really important that we also be somewhat critical of ourselves and critical of the actions we take. And I think there's a large assumption that because we're building community internally, that we're somehow not excluding others because we're so community-minded. But the thing about community and a lot of other, especially sociologists who study kind of the nature of community and community development have found is that it's also often used as a tool to exclude folks who aren't in the community, right? Where we have people who don't support development efforts in their neighborhoods, we call them not in my backyard, NIMBYs, right? They'll use community as a way to exclude others. They'll say, our community doesn't want apartments. You know, get all the community members together to come to this meeting to talk about what we need as a community, you know, and they're using it to exclude other people. And I find really often that, you know, observant Jews, who I wouldn't necessarily say it, you know, that's only from, but I think observant Jews across the board who are seeking to create these kind of spaces aren't always aware of the fact that we are excluding others, and especially others who are already in those neighborhoods. In a lot of ways, we've contributed not just to the suburbanization efforts, but also to gentrification efforts. Moving to neighborhoods that were fairly low income, and we move as, you know, big groups, going to places in New Jersey and in New York and in other areas too across the country, where we have contributed to gentrification. We've also contributed to white flight and disinvestment. Again, not just big cities on the East Coast, but Boyle Heights in LA. Used to be a really big immigrant Jewish population there, and folks got up and left and added to the disinvestment of the neighborhood, which now, oddly enough, is being gentrified because that is the neighborhood cycle, unfortunately. So I think that we don't always recognize that our efforts to build internal community are impacting the external community that already exists there. I think that there are opportunities to do community building across lines, but I think what's interesting here, we're not just thinking about, you know, having to rent from or symbolically rent from the non-Jew who lives there. But there's a whole section here where, you know, we're talking about whether the non-Jew lives in the inner courtyard or the outer courtyard. And it's clearly stated that, you know, we would be concerned that the non-Jew might kill us or that the non-Jew might present some sort of threat to us. Right. And I think that's also something we have to consider now in the U.S., whether that is an imagined reality when we think about, you know, obviously this wasn't written in a time where we have a highly urbanized, highly capitalist, like highly globalized system where Jews have a lot of wealth, Jews have a lot of power, Jews across the board, they carry a lot of weight when they come into a neighborhood. Almost universally, you can see, and that's where I mean the gentrification efforts are very evident, that when Jews move into a neighborhood, housing prices go up. So we're not talking about the same concerns that they had at the time where, you know, the tensions between Jews and non-Jews were so significant and no one was really more safe than the other, you know? Whereas here we have safety in wealth, we have safety in capitalism, we have safety in community that other groups don't have. And I do see this really, I mean, when I was in Cleveland, I used to see this really clearly when it came to policymaking too. there's a really strong sense that Jews were dominating certain policy fields, especially around public education and defunding public education for private school vouchers. And these are things we need to consider. We can't just say, well, what do you want? You know, private school is so expensive and our community needs help. But what are we doing to other communities and how are we excluding other communities? And I do think it's very spatially apparent when it comes to creating an Eruv. It really is.
Right. Thank you for that. A really important point. The idea that people are under the impression that because they're building their own community, that they don't have to worry about the communities around them. Yeah, I think about that a lot, about gentrification and the role Jewish communities play, and that I recently moved to South Philadelphia. And Philadelphia has been, you know, in a gentrification process for past number of years. And it's just, you kind of see it happening in action. And it's just kind of, it's kind of painful. It's painful to watch and makes you feel a little bit powerless.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a difficult conversation to have, because one of the things that I find, if you grow up in the observant Jewish world, is that there is a very strong emphasis on kind of micro level responsibility, micro level impact, and not a really strong conversation around macro level systems. Definitely if you didn't grow up like learning Tanya or anything Kabbalistic, which really is all about macro level systems,
right?
Like the individual doesn't even matter anymore. There's a nature to the universe that like outpaces you. You know, I think we spend a lot of time thinking about what we need to do as individuals, which is good and important. We also have very much internalized this, and in the US, very much internalized this kind of isolationist, individualistic perspective where the whole world revolves around you and you need to do these kind of things and be a good person. And if you're a good person, everything will be fine. And we forget that systems are incredibly powerful, and gentrification is a systemic issue. It's not just, you know, something that the individual can tackle. On our own, we can try to, you know, work with community groups who are fighting against gentrification. We can work within our community to encourage people who seek out monetary gain through real estate to be more thoughtful about their investments and not take an active role in gentrification, which I think is a very hard conversation to have in our community. But I think at the individual level, there really is so little we can do because, like I said, on the one hand, it's part of the neighborhood process. Like we see this, there's kind of a neighborhood life cycle where neighborhoods are invested in, then disinvested in, then reinvested in. And the reinvestment is always for an increasingly white and wealthy population. And so, you know, we can choose not to be a part of those efforts. I personally think like housing is a moral question. Where you live, where you purchase a home, you know, what kind of neighborhood you want to be in. But it's hard, because as much as we want to put weight on the individual and the firm society, so much of what we do has to do with community. And so, and this goes back to Eruv, like your Eruv literally gives you a geographic limitation as to where you can essentially buy a home. I live in Dallas now, right? Because I'm at UT Arlington, and there are areas of the city of Dallas that I would have loved to live in. There are areas in Cleveland or Cleveland Heights that I would have loved to live in that I essentially couldn't because I had kids and I needed an Eruv. And I need to get to the shuls. And zoning plays into that as well. But it's hard because we want to do things on a micro level. We also exist as a community. And then there are just macro level systems that we have so little control over that we're very not used to, because that's just not how our, I think, our educational or institutional systems work anymore. They're very focused on the individual. So it's tough. It's really tough. I think just as a community, we need to remember that we are individuals, but we're also a broader community. And like I said, I think the biggest role is really if we could, in theory, convince people who are trying to invest in real estate not to do harm as they do so.
Right.
That would make a big difference. Sadly, I don't think that's where we're at.
Such an insightful point. And also maybe, you know, educating residents about predatory, real estate practices. It's really pains me to see all the "we buy houses cash fast" signs literally all over my neighborhood. I want to like go down and take a ladder and like pull them all down.
Yes. I just wish as a community we could have better conversations around real estate. And I know I've been pushing that a little bit and getting a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
That is a frequent thing that people push back on me about. People, so many people in the community do not see any problem with real estate practices.
That's so frustrating. So thank you really for, you know, doing that work. It's not easy to go up against all that pushback. So your expertise is in urban governance. So let's get a little more specific. Following this initial discussion about shared urban spaces, the Gemara on 62b and 63a digresses into a conversation about students issuing halachic rulings contrary to those of their teachers, or even merely ruling in a place where their teacher has established halachic authority. The discussion reminded me of a journal article you recently published about balancing equity and efficiency in trainings for public officials. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and specifically how you think public policy can give a voice to citizens who are usually disenfranchised from the system or overlooked by more established groups and interests?
Generally, my focus from a human-centric focus in urban governance is on equity. It's on social equity and spatial equity. So ensuring that all, you know, social systems in a community are treated equitably, experience things equitably, and that spaces also have the same experience. Because sometimes we disconnect space from people. Like California is a great example of that, where they have all, like the state has all of these social support systems, but they refuse to build housing. Like they won't build homes, but they'll be like, oh, we'll give you all of these great social support networks as our from our public policy standpoint. So very focused on spatial and social equity. And in general, people don't give enough, and that's sort of the point of that paper, but people don't give enough credence to the fact that equity is, it's a balancing act, and that it doesn't come naturally. If you do something better, that doesn't mean it's more equitable. And that was really the point of our paper in highlighting that, that yeah, when you turn towards trying to make systems more efficient, you could very easily lose equity. And you could very easily lose that focus on ensuring that everyone has the experience that is most necessary for them. And equity isn't the same as equality. There's like an image of two kids standing next to a fence, one's short and one's tall, and says like equality is when they both get a box that's the same height so they can look over the fence. And equity is when we give them boxes of different heights so that they can both look over the fence. And that when you treat everyone equally, if people are at a different spot or if they're starting from a different place or if they're historic marginalization, they're not going to get to where they need to be. And so that's why we need to focus on equity instead. And yeah, and so I think that focus on equity is incredibly important and often overlooked. We say in the Jewish world, I think, that, you know, the arc of justice, it bends, right? And that kind of as time goes on, we are moving towards justice and moving towards more just systems. I don't know that like 2016 has really indicated that, or the time since 2016 has really indicated that. It's probably more like a slinky of justice. Like we just keep swirling around and like maybe sometimes we fall the right way, sometimes we don't, like who knows where it is at whatever point. But I think that, so it's interesting about thinking about, you know, students and their rabbinic authorities and kind of disagreeing with them and thinking back and forth about, well, how can they say this and how can they say that? Is that equity requires a different set of eyes from what we've always done previously. And in the Jewish world and in the observant Jewish world, we put a lot of weight on tradition, which is very significant, obviously. But we sometimes don't put enough weight, especially thinking nowadays about living in an era that we've literally never experienced in our lives, right? Technology, hyper-globalization, hyper-urbanization, that those fresh eyes really are valuable and that we discuss that. We talk about that reality in the Gemara. We talk about that human tendency towards having disagreements with, you know, openly having disagreements with the person who trained you, that you're going to have a different perspective and you're going to have different eyes. And my focus on urban governance really comes from that lens that things are not static. They're never static. And so either you're adjusting according to what's necessary or you're not adjusting and essentially ignoring what is necessary or not dealing with it. And so I think here in general, I think it's really interesting. We do have a culture in Judaism for as much as we have a very strong culture around tradition, we also have a strong culture around questioning, right? Mm-hmm. And I think about how some other religious groups don't have that to the same degree. And, you know, factions are really important. If you study American government at all, you know, one of the things you're going to study is federalism, and you're also going to study civil society. And so you're going to study Tocqueville and Madison and these people who really believe that if we had a bunch of little groups that could constantly fight with each other, that is how we sustain democracy. And so Judaism, ironically, you know, that is kind of a thing we have. Probably a secret to some of our, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it's a secret to a lot of our social sustainability, right? Is that we keep arguing with each other, we keep allowing diverse groups in, we have a big tent, you know, I can call myself Orthodox, I can call myself from, and I can scream and rail against something the Orthodox Union does, and I'm not out of the tent. Whereas maybe if I was Catholic and I, you know, screamed and yelled against the Catholic Church, I would just call myself a lapsed Catholic or no longer Catholic. We don't really have that. So we do put a lot of focus on, you know, self-identification and allowing one to be Jewish as they are. So, and I think here that's kind of, and you see this throughout the Gemara, obviously, like students kind of fighting with their Rebbeim. Wish we had more women doing it, but we could talk about the gender dynamics in the Gemara a different time.
But that's a really helpful way of looking at it, that we need another set of eyes to ensure equity and to sustain equity. It brought to mind your article in 2018 about the OU endorsing Jeff Sessions' announcement that he was going to look into.
I love the fact that everyone in like Trump's cabinet, you can bash them and like a year later they're a nobody.
Yeah.
And they're not there anymore. So
right. Yeah. So you said it was arrogant and even maybe ignorant of the last 50 years of history of housing in America to cry anti-Semitism over the fact that a local zoning board or committee, you know, didn't let you build your shul as big as you wanted to.
Yeah, I still very much believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like zoning laws have literally been used to keep, you know, poor and Black folks from being able to live and afford housing in communities, predominantly Black, but, you know, other communities of color as well, for sure. And so it's a total dismissal of the civil rights concerns related to zoning, to act like as if we have a claim because we moved to a new community and decided we wanted to build a big shul. I do think there's a lot of opportunity for Frum Jews to join YIMBY movements, to join Yes in My Backyard movements, and to say, hey, let's create massive density everywhere. I mean, in Lakewood, where homes are like, what is it, $500,000, $600,000 for a home? Like, why aren't we building, you know, better apartments that aren't just yeshiva apartments or, you know, couples apartments? Why don't we have more duplexes? Why don't we have more housing? You know, increase the supply, make it more affordable. I think there's a space for that, for people to be advocating for those sorts of things. But unfortunately, again, going back to that original point about kind of internal community building, we aren't really seeing that. We aren't seeing the potential that we have to enhance inclusivity across the board and across spaces. And part of that is, I think, you know, internalized racism, internalized classism that we definitely do have in our communities, especially the predominantly European communities. We definitely have that, and it's something we have to tackle. Again, something really huge that the community does not want to look at and deal with. But yeah, and you know, it's interesting because just going back to that kind of equity conversation and moving towards justice, someone recently asked me about this idea of tzedek tirdof, right? And that is actually why I responded to the OU doing that, because they presented Jeff Sessions with a plaque that said tzedek tirdof.
Right.
And so I was talking to somebody about it, and he had heard something from another public servant, actually non-Jewish, but a public servant who had heard a rabbi speak about this topic and sort of about like why there's two tzedek, and there's tzedek that's sort of this institutional tzedek in the legal system. And then there's the tzedek of, you know, making decisions that are more equitable and that really deal with the nature of the problem on the ground that might be more flexible than the institution. And it reminded me very much of Rav Soloveitchik's Holy Man of Faith, the idea of Adam 1 and Adam 2, right? And that there are these very fixed natures of man, and then there are these more flexible and fluid natures of man. And that tapping into those fluid natures is how we, you know, get equity and how we see what's really happening before us and in front of us. And we have these fixed natures and we have these mechanisms, especially in our community, that are fixed when it comes to something like an Erev, right? Like an Erev has been since the times of the Gemara, right? We've been creating Erev and we've been thinking about what an Erev is and what it involves and who's in it and who's out of it. And now is an opportunity to use that sort of community building tool to potentially, you know, live in communities that need our community building and where we can be a bridge for other communities, as opposed to, you know, well, let's just come into your community and buy up all of your land and sell it for much more. You know, we can use these community building frameworks that we have that almost nobody has to really do this sort of work. The Mormons actually do it much more similar to this, from what I hear in Salt Lake City, that they also kind of have these geographic sort of boundaries, and they see those as, for better or for worse, because you know, they do a lot more proselytizing than we do, obviously, because that's not our thing. But they do see those as opportunities to engage in the communities that they're in. And I don't think we really see that as much. So I think we can take that opportunity. I think we can, you know, play around with the atom two that we have within our system with the second tzedek and really kind of try to appeal and try to deal with some of these issues that we see in our urban communities.
That's such a beautiful connection you made between, you know, that rabbi's drasha of tzedek tzedek terdof and Rav Soloveitchik's Adam 1 and Adam 2. I love that. And also, yeah, your point about Erev, I just thought of this now, like with Parshat Vayera coming up and Avraham and Sarah's tent that was open on four sides. There's a technical reason why Erev is not, you know, walls anymore. It's telephone poles and fishing line. But you can think of the Erev as maybe like an open-sided tent and a place that's as a space that's not kind of walling our community off and keeping outsiders out, but a place that's welcoming people who are not from our community, and a place that you go out from your community and you welcome other people in. So we've been talking a lot about finding new ways to think about shared space. So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I was inspired by your JTA article from May, in which you encourage Jewish communities to think about redesigning our religious spaces to be more inclusive and welcoming for when this pandemic finally ends, or at least recedes enough to allow us to return to shul in our usual numbers. What does your dream shul look like?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. So physically, I mean, massively inclusive, right? So you're talking about definitely ADA compliant. I mean, just so many shuls aren't even ADA compliant, which is horrifying. Down to like, I mean, the bima has to be ADA compliant. You're not ADA compliant just because people can get in the door.
Right.
So that's an easy basic one. And then also designing spaces, women's and men's private spaces. So let's say, for example, bathrooms with very similar resources. Like my husband shouldn't not be able to change his son in shul because the men's bathroom doesn't have a changing table. Like the same way that, you know, you have a washing station right outside the bathroom so that he can wash his hands and go back to davening, he should be able to wash his hands after like changing a diaper and go back to davening, you know? So having these spaces that are much more just functional for families and functional for people with physical disabilities, also more functional for people with various other disabilities, including like hearing and sight related concerns. So making sure that there isn't a single spot where somebody can't hear the davening or where the clarity is lacking. So yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to think physically. And then also for obviously for folks who have other kinds of special needs and other kinds of struggles, learning disabilities, as well as, you know, further along different spectrums, I absolutely think that there are better ways to design spaces.
Wow. I love every one of your ideas. That's amazing. Continuing this discussion about the implications of private ownership for Erev use on Shabbat, the Talmud tells an interesting story further down the page. The Amoraic sage Reish Lakish and the students of Rabbi Chanina arrived for Shabbat at an inn owned by a non-Jew, but lived in by three long-term renters, one of whom was also non-Jewish. It happened to be that the non-Jewish tenant was not there, but the rabbis were concerned that he would return on Shabbat and thereby make it impossible for them to carry on Shabbat, because one cannot ask a non-Jew to rent their space, even symbolically, on Shabbat. They therefore wondered aloud whether they could rent the tenant's space indirectly from the owner of the inn. Since technically the owner had the ability to evict the tenant, could they rent from him? Or is the space entirely under the tenant's control unless he is actually evicted? The whole exchange is relevant to an article you wrote last summer in response to outcry among Jewish landlords and Orthodox publications over the new rent control policies in New York State. As you argued, the uproar, aside from ignoring the predatory practices of many of the Jewish-owned real estate companies in the area, completely overlooked the plight of the people whom these policies are supposed to help: low-income residents of apartment buildings and other multi-unit housing. And ironically, a lot of these people actually belong to the Orthodox community. So it's refreshing to see the Talmud respect tenants' rights here, especially those of a non-Jew. And arguably, the best way to get otherwise uninterested Jews involved in social justice is to educate them about issues that affect them. If we can't get them to join a tenants' union, at least we can teach them how to deal with aggressive landlords or to avoid them in the first place. Do you think that's a possibility here? And if so, what way do you see forward?
I read something a few days ago about the nature of people, the way that people distance themselves from their actual realities, if those actual realities are less than ideal, and the way that they'll continue to see themselves as a member of this idealized class, or as that they have a potential to be a member of that class, and that they'll vote for policies or they'll vote for practices where they think that they would end up there. And it was kind of a pop culture take on this idea of the veil of ignorance, which perhaps you're familiar with. This idea that, you know, if we didn't know who we were going to be in some kind of new world order, how would we construct the world order? And so this essayist was basically saying that, unfortunately, nowadays, you know, maybe it used to be that people would say, well, I'd probably be in the lowest tier, so I should construct the world order so that, you know, I'll be okay. But nowadays, a lot of people think that, like, if they were behind this veil, if they had no idea who they were going to be, they would come out and they would be Warren Buffett. You know, they would be, they think they're going to be Jeff Bezos. And so they're actively creating a world that they think they're going to be a part of. And one of the things that was really interesting to me after I wrote that article was how many people who I know who are renters were defending landlords. Yeah, and we're defending the real estate industry, where it was really interesting because I wouldn't have expected that. I would have expected them to kind of, you know, see that natural overlap with what I was writing and what their personal experiences were. But instead, they were sort of defending these people who were able to make money off of real estate, which I find really interesting. And I think really ties into that idea where they really think that they could be that person and that they don't want laws that would limit their earnings potential. But also, just going back for a minute, I do think it's interesting that the Gemara really doesn't give credence to the idea of just like eviction by the whim of the landlord, right? Where they're saying like, no, there are times where you can't, of course, like you can't kick that person out of their apartment. And if the tenant chooses to rent to you, then perhaps you can rent from them. But it's not the landlord, say, if the tenant can't be kicked out. Yeah. I think that unfortunately in today's day and age, where, you know, housing has become a commercialized asset, and especially with, I mean, the number of housing units in New York City alone that are owned by investors, they're not even owned by landlords, really. I mean, the investors become landlords and they hire management companies, but they're literal investments. They're not even that same sort of landlord-tenant relationship that we used to think about. So when we think about that, I mean, it would be wild to tell anybody in New York where there really are some good tenant rights laws, there are just reasons for which the tenant cannot be kicked out and that the landlord just does not have a say on the property. And note that the Gemara doesn't like enumerate those here. The Gemara doesn't clarify exactly what those are, but it identifies that there was some system of tenants' rights for sure. And we somehow have kind of moved away from that. In some ways, I would say, you know, there is a perhaps somewhat universal experience that a lot of Jews had as immigrants coming to the US and living in, you know, living that renter life and having landlords and then sort of becoming landlords, which is really interesting to become, you know, the oppressor that you know so closely. I think that there are these conversations that we have about this fear of like the pirates, right? The pirates, right. These are the stories that I was told as a kid, right? The pirates who like the poor Yid didn't even have two pennies for himself, and the pirates would take all of his money and wouldn't provide good services. And like that, you know, that was the landlord. And like so many Jews have become the pirates. So many Jews have become the person who says, well, I can get more money out of this apartment. So why shouldn't I be able to kick out this tenant and get more money for it? It's like, because literally we were both raised on the same stories where when that person was like a Russian in 1850, it wasn't okay. But when you're an American in 2020, it somehow is. But yeah. And so I think those are, again, you know, difficult conversations we need to have in the community about the fact that your potential right to maximize your return on investment does not negate the human rights and tenants' rights of people who you interact with.
Absolutely. Yeah, that veil of ignorance perspective, that's such an astute way of looking at it. I want to close out this amazing interview by turning the page back to something Daf Yomi learners studied around Rosh Hashanah, the time when Jews look both inward and outward for something to change. Much to the chagrin of our learners, the Talmud spends the first 25 pages or so of Tractate Eruvin imagining just about every configuration of houses and courtyards open to the public domain. It's not until the third chapter, called Bakol Me'arvin, or We May Make an Eruv with Everything, that we get to talk about the community building aspects of the Eruv. I want to focus on a dispute on 29a, where an otherwise unknown sage named Rav Menashe ben Sheguvle claims that a teaching about a minimum amount of food for giving tithes to the poor also applies to the minimum amount of food required to establish an Eruv. Another sage, Rav Yosef, gets pretty upset about this, going so far as to say that God must forgive Rav Menashe for his mistake. But on the surface, it's not such a stretch, and Rav Menashe seems to have the right idea. After all, the concept of Eruv hinges upon the sharing of food, precisely because sharing of food is an act that builds community. But obviously, an Eruv is built only for Jews, and according to the letter of the law, The requirement to provide food to poor people also only applies if the poor people are Jewish. We both know that Jewish communities have almost never had an issue with thinking about their own. But especially for Orthodox communities, thinking about people outside the community, let alone providing for them, is another story. And unfortunately, in the wake of a pandemic that has affected literally all our communities, and racial violence that affects many of our neighbors, we're seeing some Jewish communities double down on this tendency. As someone who has written and thought about these issues in the past months, what hope, if any, do you have for these communities to open themselves up to problems beyond their own?
So I think one of the things that's really interesting about urban spaces and about kind of shocks to urban spaces is that we find new opportunities to express things that we had long thought about or considered, but that we maybe didn't have a general consensus towards changing. I do actually have a lot of hope. I think I'm probably more hopeful now than I have been in a long time, because I see people taking on leadership roles in response to some of the unfortunate realities that we're facing in our communities, right? So we have COVID, we had a series of Black Lives Matter marches, we have all these other racial and economic tensions that are very, very obvious and especially clear now with the election cycle. And we're seeing new leaders pop up. We're seeing new young folks, making statements. And so I definitely think that there's way more opportunity now to create changes. I think some of these new leaders, especially women leaders that are coming up now, they're going to be able to plant themselves in positions where they can shape the future. I think they will be focused on creating change and promoting change. And I think that there really is going to be a lot of hope. When things start up again, we'll have people who can point to a time where we really struggled and be able to say, hey, we can do it differently.
Well, that's really heartening to hear. And thank you for sharing that perspective. And thank you for all the work you're doing to speak up and speak out and to model that kind of behavior, that bravery for young people. Professor Hannah Leibovitz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you heard, leave us a review, subscribe, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.